Welcome back to Old Taku No Radio, episode 22 on Robot Carnival. I am Jared. I am joined, as always, by our very own chief booze and poetry correspondent at Inigamers, Inc. Say hello, Inc.
Bite my shiny metal ass.
So, Robot Carnival, really, really excited to talk about this one. Been on the radar for a while for us. Why don't you give us kind of the high-level overview of what we're talking about here, Inc.?
The high-level box-back review, sure. Robot Carnival is an anthology collection of 9 short films, many done by animators before they got their feet wet in directing. From funny to dramatic, artistic to entertaining, each story reaches towards the furthest corners of time and space to bring you a tale of robots and the people who make them. That's from the back of the box from...
Literally the back of the box from the Discotech release?
That's the DVD release. They did put out a Blu-ray later, and which everyone should pick up because a lot of this deserves the Blu-ray treatment.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. I have the DVD because I picked that DVD up when they brought that out, I guess, 2 or 3 years ago.
Otakon, I think it was?
Yeah, at Otakon. I think they like had it kind of hit the street at Otakon that year.
I remember, because they hit the street with it, and within like 5.5 minutes had sold out of all the copies they brought.
Yeah, it was Thunderdome trying to get a copy of that that first time. Actually, I think I didn't even get a copy that debut year. I waited till the next Otakon the following year, and I picked it up. And then, of course, they went, oh, we're going to release it on Blu-ray, and I'm like, ah...
Yeah, because it's only like $4 more, so it's like, oh, crap. Yeah. Have to pay for it all over again.
Yeah, but yeah, like to your point, it's worth it. And good Lord, even on the DVD, it looks just fantastic. Like, just unbelievable.
And I think a lot of the reasons why it does is because it's not really trying to be shiny, flashy. A lot of the visuals are, you know, purposefully not antiquated, but dated. Some look not of the time, but sort of in throwback fashion. So yeah. they're visual effects that are not meant to be super shiny and elegant. So DVD works. I'd really like to see how the Blu-ray treatment does for it, though.
I think some of the animation is just timeless, the way it affects, or how affecting it is, I guess I should say. There's one in particular I was thinking about, which has that very Akira animation style.
Wait, is it the opening animation?
Well, it's not the opening animation, which, you know, oddly enough, is Katsuhiro Otomo's directorial debut is that opening animation.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy to think about, but it's the one with the two giant robots in the Meiji era. It's like the Meiji era steampunk robots.
Yes.
It has that very... Now, a lot of these people... You know, Katsuhiro Otomo kind of, I guess, was the ringleader of in terms of the creative group that came together to put out Robot Carnival. Or at least it seems like a lot of the people that worked on this project were connected to Otomo somehow. And one of those guys was a guy who worked on Akira, and which describes like half of the people, if not more, in Robot Carnival. But the animation style of the character design is very much that Akira look, and you're just seeing that, just gosh, it's just timeless. Like it affected me the same way as seeing Akira again years later did, you know, in that, you know, it really hasn't lost a step. You know, are there effects that are, you know, have we made advances in effects and animation that would just, you know, make some of the stuff in Akira look quaint, or even the stuff in Robot Carnival look quaint? Absolutely. But to your point earlier, the way it's executed, the way it's done, you know, a lot of these shorts stand the test of time. Mm. And It's just a beautiful, beautiful 90-minute journey through some very different and very, very challenging at points bits of animation. Not a whole lot of dialogue through the whole thing. There is some, but it's pretty limited.
I'd say the majority of the pieces didn't have any dialogue. There were a few in there that did, but the majority I don't think do. Or have, like, garbled peanut speak, we'll call it, for dialogue.
It did have the most just amazing soundtrack by Joe Hisaishi of Ghibli fame, I think, of lately. But he turned out the most 80s freaking synth-pop soundtrack for this thing. Just unbelievable.
For some of them. But others actually have this very wonderful background score that's just very emotive and melancholic. It suits the tone of each piece, because each one varies very, very, very widely.
Yeah, yeah.
What I kind of wanted to do was just to go through each segment and dig into what we liked, what we didn't, what we thought about it, and how they complemented the anthology as a whole.
Yeah, yeah. You're reading my mind. So I guess we'll start with the opening, since it's an opening that kind of is its own short all on its own.
It is. And I gotta say, like, I love anthology films. They're one of the most poetic things out there in terms of anime, because you get people who have to scrunch an entire story into like 5 or 10 minutes tops, and that really makes them conserve imagery, and that's my wheelhouse. the second you start letting the images tell the story, and watching what the directors choose and how they choose to move things along, that's where anime is for me. All the needless narration can go, with the anthology films, especially the ones by Otomo, like a short piece comes directly to mind, and Genius Party, both of them, and this one are pretty much my favorites in terms of openings. And why don't you describe the opening one?
Yeah, so it's basically you've got a small you got a boy who finds the scrap of a poster advertising some sort of robot carnival, and where you would think, okay, a little boy finds a poster about a carnival, awesome, this would be a happy moment, we're off to Disneyland type feels. It sort of sets off this panic kind of reaction, and he goes around telling people in the village that the carnival's coming, and it continues to have this ripple effect of just absolute panic and pandemonium. And you soon find out why, because the carnival is just this giant robot carnival logo that's sort of like Howl's Moving Castle, in that it's just this gigantic monolithic tank tread clad machine of death that just burns a path through anything it comes into contact with. And the carnival part of it are all these robots that come out, and they are carnival-esque kind of robots. You've got little ballerinas that explode after they pirouette a few times on the ground. I mean, it didn't remind me of this at the time, the first time I watched it, as many, 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 many moons ago. But it reminded me kind of a Tim Burton kind of thing, you know, like where you've got like, it's a cute little ballerina doll and it's blowing up and killing people. I mean, but Otomo, I think, has that same kind of sensibility about him. So that is really kind of cool. And that's basically it rolls through this village and just crushes it, wipes it off the map. And the villagers who survive, the few that do, are sitting on a sand dune overlooking where this giant machine has just come through and destroyed everything, and sort of looking on with this mixture of awe and horror and sadness.
And what I like about that is the sense of comedy in it, because you have this delicious sense of fanfare for this thing that's utterly decimating the landscape. and everyone who's meant to appreciate it. Meanwhile, ironically, we're specifically coming to this piece to enjoy it, and we're watching it ruin lives. I mean, they're, yeah, they're animated lives, but still.
the juxtaposition of the festival kind of atmosphere that this giant logo killing machine has with the death and destruction it's causing in its wake. It's this beautiful dynamic sort of tension between those two things, and just love it. It really, if you haven't seen a lot of these kinds of anthology films, or you particularly of the anime variety, and you haven't encountered something like that before, it's gonna set the table for you in the sense that you should just expect the unexpected and just count on everything from here on out for the next 90 minutes to be a bit off the beaten path, because oh boy, is it ever.
And to your point about the child finding the poster for the carnival, a lot of the comedy, or what sets the tone for the comedy, is his realization of what that coming carnival was, because there's a piece torn out of that flyer, because all it says is coming soon, robot, and there's something ripped off beneath it, so you don't know it's Robot Carnival yet. And you see the kid, like, reading this and trying to figure it out, and all of a sudden, when he figures out that, you know, it's the Robot Carnival that's coming, he books ass into the center of town to try to save all these, and tell everybody to, you know, in the town to save their asses. And that kind of sets the tone quite wonderfully. There's also what I wanted to point out that I loved about the segment was kind of the sound direction, mm-hmm. which I had not noticed in the previous viewing so many, many moons ago. You have everything from, like, the realistic barking of a dog that senses the tremors and the approaching danger, and he's just sort of barking into the distance, this forewarning alarm signal. And you have just the simple Foley work of realistic dishes breaking and running around and hammering nails for slats on windows and stuff like that, like preparing for a hurricane. But then you get to that rolling decimation box and all the robots flying off of it, and they're these advanced automatons or robots, and they're backed by stuff like music box music. And I'm not sure how to describe that, but it's that simple, like, hammer on steel chord pinging. Mm-hmm. So there's a dissonance there that I really love, because you have advanced technology and retro automation. And
yeah.
There's also the screeching of those ballerinas as they pirouette off the box and blow up everybody. It was kind of fantastic.
That shot of them pirouetting off the top of the logo box thing is kind of reminiscent of something you'd see from a war movie, of bombs getting dropped out of a plane, particularly like a World War II era movie where, you know, they're literally throwing bombs out of the back of a plane. It was that kind of the symmetry of that, just the, or I guess symmetry may not be the right word, but the juxtaposition of that, where you've got this happy, or what should be a happy image, a whimsical image that's also, you know, death. It's whimsical death, Inc. It's genius. So is Otomo.
Not to talk about this as solely as the opening, because one nice thing that this anthology does is actually use it as a bookend instead of just the opening piece. Did you watch all the way through the end credits?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. To what you're alluding to with the epilogue, eventually the logo kind of chugs along, and eventually the sun begins to set, and, you know, you definitely start to get a valedictory kind of feel to the show. You know you're coming to the end of the anthology, and the sun rises again, and it attempts to crest over this dune, and it just finally collapses down into the desert, into a ruin. And years pass, and I think, let me pause there for a minute, I think in the original Streamline Pictures release, in like the very early 90s, 1991 or 1992, which is where the last time I saw this. So I have not, even despite having owned it for a couple of years now, I have not seen it in over half my life. So really weird to see it again. And I still remembered it fairly clearly. I was surprised how much of it I remembered from watching it. But anyway, I think that was the ending as far as the Streamline Pictures release was concerned, is the logo falling apart. So what happens kind of past that is, years later, this man, he looks vaguely Bedouin, kind of inspired at least, finds this orb, and he brings it back to his family, and it's turns out to be a little music box. It features it's got a little robot ballerina in it, and the robot ballerina starts dancing.
We all know what happens when robot ballerinas meets people.
And it's kind of clever because it stretches this moment out like just long enough for you to think, well, maybe it's okay. Maybe nothing's gonna. Uh oh. And then the children, the man's children are like all gathered around it, and they're charmed by it, and the whole family is kind of just enjoying this little music box, and then the entire house blows up, and in its place you see giant letters end, and a poor llama struggling to get back on its feet, the sole survivor of this calamity that has befallen this poor family. So that's how it ends, very much how it begins.
Did you sense that bit of trepidation, like in that drawn out scene? Wonderfully so, as you had said. There's the sense, when he puts the orb on the table and you hear an audible click and that orb starts to transform into that ballerina music box. There's, at least as I read it, and I may have been reading it too much as a viewer and not a character in the scene, but it feels like, as you mentioned, it takes place somewhat later, that these kids are aware of the horror of robots by this point, so that when the father activates a robot, there's a sense of trepidation, a real sense of, oh shit, we're gonna die. And, then the thing just sort of behaves like a toy. And they start to love it, and then of course they die. So
I think that's absolutely valid. I kind of felt like with the sand had completely covered the ruins of the wrecked machine, and a whole age had passed. So to me, in my mind, I kind of, the way I world build that whole scene in my mind is, okay, this is like a whole nother age of existence, and almost akin to like what you would find in some sort of fantasy setting. This guy finds what essentially may as well be a magic item to these people, and he brings it back to his family, and it turns out to be this bomb, basically. But I do think you definitely can get a sense of trepidation around what is this thing. It's a lot more than just a steel ball, and there is a flash of fear from them. But so I think it's quite valid to interpret. Maybe they've had some sort of ancestral knowledge about the terror of the robot carnival, and they paid for it in the end. But I guess, moving past the opening and ending, I don't know if you want to walk through every one of these, but I'm happy to. The first short up after that is kind of, it's called Franken's Gears.
Mm-hmm.
And as the title might suggest, it's very inspired by a Frankenstein type story. What did you think about that one?
I really loved it. It's another silent one. It's completely silent, except for mechanical noise. And I love the fact that human voice is sort of completely forsaken for the grinding of gears, and again, the Foley work, because that really emphasizes the focus on the mechanical. And this is just sublimely lighted. It's goofy. It takes Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and sort of turns it on its ass, because the robot is beloved by its creator, not abandoned by it. And in the end, through all his attempts at bringing life to his creation, he actually meets his fate because of a childlike, innocent imitation instead of abandonment issues and discrimination. And I thought it was a very, very cute way to turn it without being absolutely cute, because the way the robot comes to recognize the evil or the mad scientist as father is organic, or it felt organic. And I liked the way that sort of played with the humanity robot overall theme that this anthology is based on.
Yeah. I got major Pinocchio vibes from this both times that I've watched it now. You know, the old man in the short really reminded me of Geppetto, and especially with the love that he had clearly for his creation, and for wanting to give it life, and he struggles so hard to give it life, and that's where it sort of blends in the sort of Frankenstein feel, is where you know he's twisting the levers and pulling on the stuff and it's not working, and he gets a little frustrated and he keeps going, and he finally triumphs, and you know it's Frankenstein, but it felt like Frankenstein with a dash of Pinocchio to me, and then it has that horribly tragic ending, despite the fact that it's a really nice transition from the opening, because one of the qualities it shares with the opening, despite being very different, is this whimsical kind of tragedy that occurs in the course of the story. So really, to your point about the sound, really loved the way that it was very understated with the sound, and so much of this is focused on just the visual, and the sound is only there to augment that rather than contributing equally to the telling of the story.
Let's say augment and complement. It's a bit pedantic, but because of the
pedantry.
Sorry. I to go along with that, some of the visuals, the lighting effects, especially because you have this. There is a thunderstorm going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that gives rise to the electric sparks and sort of the Tesla sparks that we've become, you know, come to associate with that. That sort of illuminate the laboratory really beautifully, and not wholly, just, you know, just in shades and tones. There's a moment where the robot starts to generate life, and there's something of a heartbeat underneath it, which I didn't like, but there was the effect of the lighting, because the ball of light around the robot's heart started to grow and grow, and you start to see the scientist, and who's looking eagerly on at this reanimation or initial animation, and he smiles exactly in time with the growing of that light. And that was the only thing I didn't like. I think his smile should have been a little more reactionary than in sync. But that aside, it was kind of perfect, because the way light envelops everything and grows and illuminates really does it's beautiful. It's just straight up beautiful.
The washes of color, the way they convey emotion, I thought was really effective. You know, augmented by the shading, augmented by the sound effects, or complemented by the sound effects. Just a really economically told and very effectively told little story. You know, using very familiar themes to kind of help eliminate any needed exposition. You kind of already you know, as soon as you see all sort of the trappings of a Frankenstein type story, you already have a certain set of conceits that you're bringing yourself, whether you want to or not. You just kind of go, oh, it's this kind of story.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely counts on that.
Oh yeah, and it's all about how the story twists it from there, and because it was sort of a goofy, lovingly told story about a father who just wanted to create and did, and then just made a inevitable human error with a robot child. It kind of builds up to its own demise in its own way when you look at it like that. Like, it foretold that happening, because robots are not humans, so...
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was really, really, really decent.
Yeah. So, the next short in the series was called Deprive, or Deprive, I guess, if you're just speaking English and not reading, thinking about it in Japanese, like I just did, but...
Please do explain the difference.
Yeah. katakana. So this was my favorite at 12 years old. Like, absolutely, this was it, man. This was the thing. This one was very easy to understand, very straightforward. But now adult me goes, wait, but what? But how? What, who? What? Huh? It's like, what now? Basically, there is a alien invasion. There's an attack on a city. This you know, there's death, there's destruction. This young girl gets kidnapped. She's got this android friend that she cares about quite a great deal. Tries to defend her, but it's pretty badly beat up. It kind of has a locket that she gave the android as sort of a keepsake of her as she's taken away, and then we cut to this dude who's basically
Cobra
or Kashern. he's like chopping up robots like just Ginsuing through them basically with his bare hands. So as soon as I saw that, I thought, oh, Kashern, okay, cool. Kashern with, like, none of the hang-ups that Kashern has. And so eventually, though, he's captured after he gets, like, shot by this really cool robot with, like, guns that come out of the chest. I mean, again, 12-year-old me is here for this short. He's captured and he's like electrocuted in this like clearly 80s evil base, the most evil of 80s bases,
with a clearly 80s evil David Bowie villain.
Yes, the clearly evil David Bowie villain that very looks just amazing, beautiful aesthetic with that guy, and we find out that the human dude is actually the android guy, but he's like definitely gone through some upgrades and he's more powerful and somehow looks human, he breaks free and he fights some robots and he fights the David Bowie guy, who turns out has a very effective eye laser only in one eye. Not sure why it's just one eye. I would kind of want to do the set myself, but so be it. And he saves the day and he's reunited with the girl, and she realizes that it's her android buddy with the necklace, and there's this really kind of driving synth kind of keyboard score kind of through the whole thing, and you're like, fuck yeah, 80s, man, yeah.
Seriously, if you love Dirty Pair, watch this short.
This is some good old 80s stuff right here. Yeah, and it's great.
One of the things I actually like about this is that it's also completely silent, despite it being so ridiculously convoluted. Because, like you said, like it, one of the things that binds the two protagonists together is what is it, a locket?
Yeah.
That one wears. So you can realize that one is bound to the other through this thing, and they use that because, like Jared mentioned, the robot changes form, not only robot form, but a human as well. And what I kind of liked about that was that calls back to the initial conflict of the initial robot invasion of Earth, which spawned, you know, the whole war in the first place, and this sort of forbidden love between the robot and the woman. But by having the protagonist switch between being either one or the other, or being illustrated as more as one or the other, that really drove the point home of what the conflict of the story was, not just the plot. So it's a bit ham-fisted, but for something that's like 5 minutes long tops,
yeah,
I didn't think it was bad at all.
No, I mean, like,
it's cheesy. You know, it's 80 it's, cheese, but
it's, oh god, it's so 80 cheesy. But you know, and the narrative that's, you know, built through it, you know, doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You kind of have to just kind of like, yeah, okay. I mean, you literally go from, you know, android who's beat up to smash cut human who fights like Kashurn to being captured to now he's actually the android but a different, more upgraded version. And you know, like, the music, I love the music for this one. But one of the things I think that the music does not do for this short that it does for the others is it complements and augments and enhances the narrative that the visuals are telling. Mm. And this is just like, fuck yeah.
It's very driving. Yeah.
Yeah, there's not a lot of... this is ass-kicking music. This isn't like... There's no... There is no subtlety around the music that is playing in this narrative a little bit, but pretty fun.
Mm. So the next one up is Presence, and that's directed by Yasuome Umetsu.
Yeah.
And Kite and
good old Kite.
Mezzo Forte and unfortunately Wizard Barristers.
And Galeodonna and a few other things.
A few other things. Yeah.
You know, it's actually kind of crazy how he is still like at it.
He's riding those kite reciprocals.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
But he's still doing a fair bit of work here and there. You know, more than you would expect. But anyway, yeah. So Presence. This is an interesting one.
I love it. It's very tonal from its very beginning. Unlike others, it just doesn't, it does sort of cold start, but it has the typical cold start and then title and then actual follow through. And it's all basically about this inventor, this toy maker, who lives a very simple life. He's married. He has basically everything he wants, but he just tinkers around. There's just something he's not getting, so he builds this hybrid gem/rainbow-bright robot in a basement in a countryside house far away, and doesn't really realize the consequences of building an artificial intelligence. And that's basically that, and the consequences of that is what this story is about.
Yeah, this is one of, I think, only a couple that have like dialogue in them.
And it does need it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the, you know, one thing to add to what you've just mentioned is the setting of this is very Victorian looking, but you've also got some structures in place and some things like these very futuristic looking kind of cars, but they sort of have an anachronistic sort of look, but they're actually quite high tech, that, you know, you're definitely in some sort of sci-fi kind of setting. You're despite the sort of the throwback look of everything.
I'd say it's more anachronistic because you have the futuristic cars which are hovering, and then you have people herding sheep across the road in very rural settings. So you definitely have a dissonance between city and country life. And there is that Victorian setting, because there's like this old-timey robot that kids kick the head off of and then use as a running gag throughout the piece, which is actually quite funny.
Yeah, and that's actually how it kind of starts off, and it kind of feels like it's going to be this little short, little transitory segment before you get to the real thing, but it turns out to very kind of smoothly build itself up, and I liked that about it, that it had that sort of feel to it. The look and the aesthetic of everything in this short is really fascinating, really great. The fluidity of motion that is used. Yeah, I think this whole anthology is done at 24 frames.
It is. But this is the first one that actually feels like it.
Yeah, and holy moly, like you see this, and the movements are very, very lifelike, like almost Uncanny Valley kind of lifelike. One of the very first shots is this guy eating soup, and the lips are like so well defined as he's eating the soup. It's really arresting when you start getting into this. But yeah, it has this real the kind of the plot with the building of the doll slash robot has this sort of repressed sexual kind of undertone to it. Or this is the way I kind of read it now as an adult. I watched this at 12 and went, I don't know what the hell's going on here, man. Like, this is really weird. Why does that guy have a really weird forehead? but the basically everything kind of comes to a climax when the robot sort of wants to have a relationship with the toy maker, and there's this scene. I think this is what like absolutely cinches it for me as this sort of there's this whole sexual current to it. Is there's a shot of a frog with a like a little frog toy with a screw, a very long screw coming out of its stomach, like right before the guy kind of like flips out at the robot's advances and then basically proceeds to destroy the robot by beating it to death with a wrench. And
how awesome was that shot of him rising the wrench like just behind his back?
Yeah. I mean, it's a really well done and interesting kind of climax in that you do not see that actually happen on camera. You see that suggestion of it, and then you're not there anymore. You've kind of jumped forward in time.
Well, not exactly. To your point, that toy you were describing. All you do during that entire scene of violence is stare at that frog as it starts to motion forward on its own and then sort of topple over, and then the light change just goes to white and black to sort of signal that lack of color, the lack of vibrancy, the lack of light.
And the frog's like kind of teeter-totting forward, and you see, and I forgot about this, and I meant to mention it, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because now it reminds me of the thing I wanted to mention. That made a lot of sense.
Before I distracted you, yes, go ahead.
But the frog, like you said, begins to move forward, suggesting that the guy's going to act on something. And these little sort of devil-looking toy cherubs that have been kind of flying around,
and farting.
One of them smacks into the frog, and you know, you kind of there's this kind of element of sin that kind of, you know, I interpreted that as that happens in that moment, and it's there's almost a slightly uncomfortable tie between sex and violence, which, you know, Umetsu, like that's a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that happens, then it goes black and white, like you say, and then we jump forward in time. The guy's older, his own daughter's grown up, has a daughter. He's sitting on a porch, being an old guy with a really fleshy neck and still has a really weird forehead.
Realistically old. We'll just call it realistically old.
Yeah, realistically old. That works. like really long eyebrow hair. It's like really
like some of the eyebrows when I'm like 76. I really do. If I live to 76, I want those fucking eyebrows.
Unless I'm reclaiming like a mine that's been taken over by a dragon, I do not want those eyebrows.
They're like weeping willows.
Like, I better be after my lost gold with those eyebrows. But but yeah, this guy sitting on his porch, he's an old man now, has a vision of the robot, and it you know, you're not sure if it's a vision, but it kind of quickly becomes apparent that it is, because the robot starts trying to move towards him and starts kind of blowing up in parts and pieces and in places. And then there's this really disturbing image of oil starting to kind of leak like blood out of you know, streaming down the extremities of this robot, first down the arms, and then there's a really disturbing scene of this oil kind of just moving more like blood kind of down the android's legs, right?
I was so hoping they were going to avoid that. I was like, please don't make it menstrual.
But then they do, and it was like, oh, and then the face falls away, and it's this very arresting image, and you've got nuts and bolts kind of falling all over it, all over the place, and just a really interesting scene.
What I like about that, though, after the faceplate is shown falling to the ground and breaking it to some degree, he's still fervently reaching out towards her, like he still wants her. Like, there's no facade of falling for this android as a human. He's falling for his creation, and he still considers it a great love. I liked that, because it wasn't as depraved as some of his other works might be.
And the creator here very much has a... there's a mix of emotions that clearly he's tormented by his decision to destroy the robot.
Because he was a younger man then, and he really didn't know, A, what he had really done, and didn't know how to deal with it either. Now that he's an older man, he has sort of made amends with his grievance and or his shame, and sort of knows how to process it now and wants forgiveness. And that's all coming through as illusion, because he's dreaming of seeing her in the first time we see her. The second time we see her, however, it's a little bit of a different analogy. And the second time we see her, he's just said goodbye to his granddaughter, who's come to visit him and his daughter, and his wife tells him to come on in off the porch because it's going to get cold, and he doesn't respond, and he has that second vision of the android or the robot he's made come to visit him and take him away, and he does start to walk away with her. And when he does, that's very much a metaphor for him dying.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, the woman who is his wife sees him walking off with the robot, who she's never seen, supposedly, because there's a very distinct scene of the old man going back after the first vision into the basement and treading under years of dust to go see this robot. And it looks like, you know, the scene has been untouched. She's still in her murdered state underneath the broken mirror. So there's no reason for us as viewers to think that the wife should know about this, but still she sees him, or her. And it's a little muddled ending, but...
Yeah.
Effective.
The wife, you know, in the introduction to her, you know, she's this powerful businesswoman that we don't see her face at all. She's not humanized at all. And then in the very end, when she's an old woman and she's like, where's my husband? He has disappeared and dropped off the face of the earth. And, you know, you've got this whole transcendental kind of resolution where the guy sort of finally disappears with the robot that he's been obsessed over. Now she's a person. Now we see her face. And it's just sort of like, okay. Umetsu, man.
I mean, the ending's a bit muddled, but I really do like the fact that it does call back to Franken's Gears, because this is an actual Frankenstein moment. Because in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, the scientist Frankenstein freaks out when he creates that monster and it starts to live. Because he's like, oh shit, what kind of a monstrosity have I made? And the scientist here does the same thing when the robot starts to sort of come on to him. And it's like, oh, I didn't expect this, let's kill you. And in Frankenstein, the novel, the scientist runs away, and the monster suffers abandonment issues. In this one, they just sort of outright kill her. But what I like about this one is that it sort of reinstalls the sense of the grotesque missing from Frankengears, or twisted from Frankengears, and it exploits that hidden shame from shots of rotting or decaying robot flesh of discarded robots and dumpsters. So you know that these things, at least on the outside, are semi-organic, and that sort of lets you attach feelings to them.
Yeah, you know, when you hear all of the talk about, you know, from like the narration from the viewpoint character, for the most part, about how, you know, he supposes he's a feminist and, you know, he supports his wife's like career and all that stuff, and but then you juxtapose that with like all of the kind of repressed sexual feelings and the brutal killing of this very human looking robot. You know, there's a lot to take in there. Lots of, you know, well, and the guy even says, like, in his sort of monologue, that he never knew his mother, he never really had any kind of relationship with a mother, never had a mother, I think, was the way they actually explained it.
He never knew a mother's love.
Never knew a mother's love, that's it. So,
which originally made me think he was a robot himself, but was not the case.
That right there tells you, like, oh boy, here we, mommy issues, here we go. Oh boy. So this is like such an Umetsu thing. This is like Umetsu doing Umetsu at peak Umetsu in so many ways, because like this guy, you see a lot of these kinds of weird blends of female agency and misogyny kind of intertwined through so much of the things he's done. Thankfully not lately, but yeah. Anything else on presence?
I don't think so.
All right.
I do have a tagline for Starlight Angel, though.
Oh, yeah?
Girl spurned by handsome man turns to robots as companions, who turn out to be handsome men. Film at 11.
Yeah. This is like such a nice little palate cleanser. It is very saccharine. To me, Starlight Angel, to me, when I think of 80s anime, I think of the guy who did Starlight Angel. I think of his character designs, because it's Hiroyuki Kitazume who did, I think at a minimum he did the character designs for Zeta Gundam and Double Zeta Gundam and Char's Counterattack, but I think he was also... he was animation director for some of Zeta Gundam, and maybe some of Devil Zeta Gundam. So like a lot of, and that's only like some of the stuff he's done. He did some Dumbine, did some Elgaim. I mean, like, you want to think about like good old 80s stuff with mecha. it is this dude, and his character designs are so freaking 80s. Double Zeta Gundam, to me, has the most peak 80s character designs. And Starlight Angel has pretty much straight up those same character designs. It's two girlfriends kicking around, having a good time at a robot-themed amusement park. And then there's a bit of a John Hughes kind of moment where one of the girls finds out that her boyfriend is now dating her friend. And she runs away in tears, but before that happens, she's dropped her kind of star pendant that this robot finds, and it's pretty much a music video.
Very much so.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a music video, and it has this very super 80s saccharine kind of music, and you know, synthy poppy kind of music. And this amusement park, it's a robot themed amusement park, but it's like Disneyland but with robots and like lots of neon everywhere. And
oh man, there's a Disneyland. There's the castle, yeah. There's the monorail, there's like everything in there. It's supposed to like be the land of fantasy.
Yeah, like all you need is some like Lisa Frank shit in there, and it's like the most 80s that 80s ever 80s. And you know, this robot that picks up the pendant, you know, is absolutely enchanted with her, love at first sight, and starts running around, following her, trying to find her, and eventually she somehow again, this is pretty much a music video, somehow summons a giant like evil kind of mecha thing that the park robot takes on, eventually brandishing, basically turning her pendant into a lightsaber, and kicking the crap out of this mecha, and he sort of rescues her. They have a moment, and you have a couple of smash cuts back to her friend, we haven't mentioned this. The boyfriend basically is Shar Aznable. Like, he looks exactly like Shar Aznable. I think he's Shar Aznable, folks. So Shar, being the asshole that he is, breaking more hearts even in different realities where he's just, you know, some dude,
guy.
Probably named Chad, you know, who works in like real estate or insurance or something.
He's a Republican.
I mean, you know, well, the way he's dressed up, that's probably true. You know, just, yeah, clearly Shar Aznable, guys. She basically slaps crap out of him. It's like, how could you do this? Like, you're a jerk. Go away. And the two friends have, the two teenage girl friends have a rapprochement at the end. And then we find out that they're waiting on someone to get off work, and it turns out that the park robot is actually a dude who now is the broken-hearted girl's new beau. So good, so saccharine. What I love about this thing the most is, to me, like, everything I love about 80s anime, late 80s anime, is right there.
Oh yeah, the music, the character designs, but like you said, how she somehow summons the robot. I think it's a take on Magic Mountain, which would make no sense. I don't think, because that was introduced to the park way later. But it's definitely a ride in the park, because she sort of gets picked up and put on this ride where she's entered into this virtual reality realm. And that's where the huge robot battle takes place, and where the robot that lost her found her lost pendant comes to save her, and ends up, you know, being the ultimate love of her life. It was convoluted as hell, and it kept switching pace, but it was a fun watch, and just totally 80s. And you sit back, you watch it, and you go, that looked pretty, that was fun.
Yeah, like, don't, like, there is no deeper message behind this. You know, it's like very, very, very different from Presence. Like, it's the perfect counterbalance to Presence. So I think in terms of arranging the shorts, I think this was a brilliant move to juxtapose those.
The only thing I will praise in this is the storyboarding of how we find out the robot is a human. Because the robot literally loses his head after he stumbles through a crowd and falls down and his head pops off. But the way the framing is done, we don't actually see the head. We just see up to, like, the shoulders. And
yeah.
You see the head stumble forward, and then the body picks up and goes above the camera, or at least where the head is, goes above the camera, and then goes down and he kicks up the head and puts it back on. And then we get to see him running away full frame. So it never really gives away the fact that, you know, it's just a guy in a robot suit at a robot park.
Yeah, and you buy it because, sure, of course robots can, like, lose their head and, like,
exactly.
like run and pick it up. I mean, like, every robot thing since Star Wars has taught us that. So, like, yeah, you know, like, that's totally what you do.
It's okay. The CPU is in your heart, not your head. That's the thing.
One interesting note about Starlight Angel is that, according to the liner notes of the soundtrack for Robot Carnival, which, God, I wish I could get my hands on that, the styling of this whole short was influenced by A-ha's Take On Me video, which is also an amazing video, and also an amazing song. So, and it absolutely tracks that's some inspiration for this, because it's very much the same kind of story.
I dig that.
Yeah. So after that one, we are to, I think, perhaps my favorite one.
I'm in agreement. We come to Cloud by Mao Lamdo Kaorsian. Because he's from Cloud City. Do you get it? Mao Lamdo actually also goes by Manabuo Hashi.
Yeah. Dear listeners, please, as always, with your hate mail to Otaku No Radio, please send that to evanmento@anagamers.com. Thank you.
This I really liked because it just stops that whole progression from the saccharine sweetness of the previous installment, and it's just art house film. All you get is this man against world thing where all you see is a robot born of the clouds, literally wandering from right to left along a straightforward plane like Mega Man at the end of Mega Man 2 or 3, I can't remember. And it's just purely atmospheric, and there's sort of this passage of human art and experience done abstractly in the background, all while you get this sort of sense while this robot is just sort of trying to find himself. And he's just wandering and wandering and wandering, and that's it. It's like, it feels like the longest of any of them, because you're just looking at the static scene with moving backgrounds, but my God, some of those backgrounds are amazing, and just the progression of everything and the tonal experience of it all just makes it an amazing piece.
Yeah, that Cloud, of all of these, you know, again, as much of a hard tonal shift as you had from Presence to Starlight Angel, you have it again in Starlight Angel to Cloud. And Cloud is very, very atmospheric. It's very contemplative. The character, kind of the central character in the animation, pretty much just has his back to everything. There's a very strong sense of isolation on the part of that character. Eventually, in the sort of the resolution of the short, a cloud spirit, or perhaps an angel of some kind, sort of takes pity on the robot, and there's this transformation where you know, the robot looks a bit more humanized looking. He looks like a little clown boy at the end. I don't know if he's one of the clown people, or if he's like a human, or what.
But I think he's supposed to be more equated to like a cherub.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely like a transformation that takes place at the end of the sequence, and it's a happy ending, and just a really, really amazing bit of etching kind of style. It's very sketchy, scratchboard kind of looking.
An amazing instance of etchy?
Sketchy.
Sorry, I couldn't resist.
I guess I should add the hate mail bit back in here. But this is just an amazing, amazing piece. And I think it's one that really... I really do think, and I like so many of I don't think there's a short I particularly hate or dislike. There's some that work for me more than others. Cloud, I think, probably bored me utterly as a kid because I didn't really like. It was kind of neat looking, but it didn't really leave an impression with me. But as an adult, and a weeaboo who has honed his critical skills a little bit, this is it's so good. It's so good. And yeah, I think probably my favorite of the whole thing.
It is, and I like the way that the ending, as you have mentioned, that final transformation of, which actually comes around because he finally looks back at this, at the gods sort of glowing at his back, at the light shining. He sort of answers the call of the heavens from which he was born, and he turns into this angelic being or clown boy or cherub, whatever he is. I like that take because it's a robot again gaining sort of this human essence, a soul that is then sort of sanctified. And that, if you want to hear more about that, you can listen to our Ergo Proxy episode, because that's what happens to all the auto rays as they contract a certain virus. But I dug Cloud's minimalism and the presentation. The fact that a lot of it looked like animated woodblock prints, and even though, like you said, everything is animated in 24, every single piece of this is animated in 24 frames per second, this was sketchy and purposefully.
It's all kind of done in transitions.
Yeah, but that works for it. They make the most of it.
Absolutely, and extremely minimal and economical use of color. There's hardly no color in this entire short, except right at the end, you've got this kind of multicolored sparkle that sort of happens at the moment of the transformation taking place, and then when the robot looks back and he sees the sun, basically the clouds are gone and it's just he's enveloped in light, and just it again really beautiful.
And that rainstorm is freaking amazing. I'm a sucker. Yes. I'm a sucker for water imagery, but that rainstorm, how it begins softly and develops into this blowing maelstrom, is just wonderful.
Yes, it's that. Well, Cloud is so good.
So we've come to Strange Tales of Meiji Machine Culture, aka the Westerners' Invasion. as old Taku no Radio's. History, Japanese history buff and foreign correspondent. Would you care to take us through this, Jared?
Yeah, so this is early Meiji period, so 19th century, you know, just, again, Meiji era is right at the end of the Tokugawa Bakufu, so the end of the shogun period of Japan, and basically, the Meiji period, I think this is very important context for this particular short. The Meiji period is sort of the end of the shogunate, and the beginning of the Meiji period is sort of heralded by the arrival of the black ships, as they are called in Japanese terms, which is basically the steamships where the United States sailed into Tokyo Bay with their big steamships and wanted to discuss opening up the country, which in the 19th century is more or less a industrial military power telling another country without the same technology base, hey, you're going to open up and give us coaling rights, or we're going to just, you know, bombard your coast.
Or to paraphrase a line from the short, if it was English, we'd have a chance, but I haven't had the time to study American.
Yeah, so that is very important context, because basically what you have is you have this American mad scientist and a giant robot attempting to take over Japan, but then this band of young kids has a robot of their own that they built for a festival that they're going to use to defend Japan. And the design of both of these robots is amazing and wonderful, because one of them is like made of bricks and it has this weird kind of, you know, like the kind of architecture I guess you would have seen in parts of Nagasaki at the time, where you had a lot of foreign influence or something like that. It looks kind of whimsically Victorian. and the mad scientist guy, there's nothing about this mad scientist guy that makes him look particularly American. He speaks English in the actual short, and so this is actually subtitled in Japanese for the parts where he's talking, and it's like actual English. I think they got a actual English voice actor to do it, if I remember the credits correctly. They did, and the Japanese robot is like this. It's almost like a walking hodgepodge of different things you would see in an early Meiji, late Edo period Japan, kind of like the chest of the robot looks like a big kind of taiko drum, like sideways, and like it has like roofs for shoulders, and there's just the design of this thing. It's so intricate and so detailed. Both of them are so intricate and so detailed. Just watch this and marvel at the way these things are designed. It's absolutely beautiful. Visually, the design, the character designer for this is a guy you may have heard of called by the name of Yoshiyuki Sadamoto, who, if you know anything about Gainax, you might know who that guy is. Done a couple things here and there. You know, knows a little bit about robots. Turns out in the future he makes some cool robot stuff, or is involved in some cool robot stuff. But here, the styling and the look of this short looks so much like something you will see, you know, in Akira, the visual styling of Akira, like, and even kind of some of the themes. You know, you've got like young kids rebelling against an oppressive force. In this case, it's a foreign invader. And it's a very whimsical sort of Miyazaki-esque in some ways, but really sort of propagandistic too. There's quite a strong nationalist sort of thread through this that sort of harkens back to Imperial Japan. But I guess for the period, it kind of makes sense.
There is, but there's also, like, it's not entirely imperialistic, because there's the constant referral to the tenements, so they're outwardly acknowledging the disassociated peoples in that state, and because those are the ones that suffer throughout this entire what I deem the slowest mech battle in history, which is a large part of the comedy in this, because you know it's appropriate for the time and the imagined tech, what could be built from that era. And, you know, if you have one robot that's built entirely via multiple batteries filling this barrel-chested mech, and, you know, they're not, you know, efficient batteries in the slightest, and you have the Japanese one that's built by, powered by steam, and literally ripping off chunks of itself to power itself to get itself to the meeting place where these things will meet, and in the end they both fall in a river. So it's totally anticlimactic, but all throughout, the only thing that has real importance in this, because you have the goofiness of the battle between the protagonist and the antagonist, but really the only sympathetic characters are all the people who are being crushed out of their homes that are already poor to start with. And it's like, guys... it's such an overlooked aspect of this, but I really love that.
Well, and I think too, you know, this is I think that's part of the point, you know, too, is that you have this you know, very, you know, nationalistic, hey, I'm going to show you the power of a genius, and you know, look at how my great Western technology is going to take over this country. And And then, you know, on the other hand, you have like these very nationalistic, patriotic young Japanese kids that are powering the most hobo steampunk Voltron ever. And they're like completely goofy and adorable. The folly of it all is that the actual people they're trying to protect are suffering because, you know, it's just like every Godzilla movie you've ever seen. Like Tokyo, I don't know that this is Tokyo. Like, I almost feel like it's they don't say where it is, but I almost feel like it's Nagasaki or it's somewhere with a heavy Western influence, in Japan. But by the end of it, like you said, they've both fallen into a river. Nobody's really won anything, and the Westerner escapes in sort of a subunit of his robot that he's pedaling away with a bicycle to try to power to get away. So my greatest regret about this is that we don't have more of this.
I think those are the perfect length, because I hate giant robots, but I love this short. This is the perfect length for me. It didn't outstay its welcome. It just sort of was perfect in its own right and left. I appreciate it for that.
Yeah, the mechanical design for this, by the way, it's such genius, and it's done by Mahiro Maeda. So again, very famous guy. He did some of the mechanical design in Evangelion for the Angels. Critically and importantly, mechanical design for Escaflowne, or The Vision of Escaflowne, if we're being technical, and Last Exile, two things I adore. You know, dude's designed a lot of cool stuff that goes beyond anime. Even he's got film credits to his name. Brilliant, brilliant guy. So many of these people in Robot Carnival go on to have storied careers, and by the point we're at now, they're all pretty much well known and highly respected animators. But yeah, this one's good. The next one is, which is the final film, the final short in the anthology, is called Chicken Man and Redneck. And why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, it takes place in Georgia, and sorry, I had to.
This Chicken Man and Redneck.
I don't know why you didn't bring out your southern accent to introduce this one. I just don't know, beyond me.
Well, we can't overpower people with southern accent. You know, we gotta moderate that as much as we can.
So this is Chicken Man and Redneck, and it's subtitled Nightmare, or alternatively titled Nightmare. And it's directed by Takashi Nakamura, who he worked on a lot of things, but I don't think has really gained prominence on a lot of things. And after the first time I watched this, I remember thinking, what the hell did I just watch? And the second time, well, the whole thing is basically another sort of robot invasion uprising sort of thing, where this large robot is sort of giving life to other robots and taking over a city slowly, and all these mechanical things that humans have built are coming to life and turning into robots to do something. There's large vines incapacitating elements of the city, and there's this one dude on a Vespa who is somehow evading all of the evil robot army and their special assassin that comes after them. And it's kind of wonderful. It's another ambient piece, despite all the action, but it's largely a sit back and watch everything happen sort of thing. What was your take on it, Jared?
I've barely seen Fantasia, but I understand that this segment was inspired by one of the segments in Fantasia. It kind of makes me want to go back and watch Fantasia. I saw Fantasia in the movies, like literally in the movies, because again, old Taku no Radio, and I have not seen it since. So I don't have any frame of reference for the source material, but this to me was like Tim Burton's jaunt through, like it had that similar kind of sinister sort of, you know, the machines come to life and they're going to be whimsical and slightly menacing, and they're going to chase this guy around, and I guess the organic nature of the way the machines kind of grow up and meld together and all that. You see that in some anime, like that's a theme that seems to come up every now and then, you know. But I really liked the sort of wild sort of fever dream of it all.
Mm. Now, I did not know that the I did not read that the origin was sort of a take on one of the Fantasia pieces, but it made sense because my first thought after rewatching it now was it's totally Night on Bald Mountain, X'd with Night Parade of 100 Demons from Nero: Rise of the Yokai Clan, sort of except with robots, and. This atmospheric piece is one that's, as you said, menacing. It's filled with intimidation and threat, and a large bit of humor as well with that through story with the guy on the Vespa. But that makes a lot of sense now. But I remember initially seeing this and just sort of going, okay. It looks neat, but it runs a little deeper with that source material.
Yeah. It's a really interesting piece. This is one where I kind of wonder. It's interesting. It's not my favorite, but I like the tension that it has, kind of running through it throughout. That it does really well.
There's a very cat and mouse element to it, or maybe not cat and mouse, but just. Like I said, constant tension. Dude's constantly trying to... He wakes up drunk, or from being drunk, so, you know, he's still drunk, and he's just trying to sort of take in this new world that's taken over while he's, you know, been incapacitated, and he's trying to maneuver through it, and maybe this is the whole metaphor of it, someone sort of awakening to new experience and trying to navigate. But that aside, if it's not that... It's purely this simple tale of a guy trying to make his way through all these threats to some sort of safe place, but there is no safe place that he can possibly reach.
Yeah. But, you know, pretty fun. And, you know, just a nice little... one of the things I think that... It's sort of a recurring theme throughout all of these different, very different, disparate... segments is the mixing of sort of pseudo fantasy themes with extremely sci-fi elements. You know, so much of what you see in each of these has this sort of feel of the sublime or feel of something that's a flight of fancy, but it's with steel and chrome and circuits, you know, and it's again another kind of juxtaposition that you have in these films that just make it all the more interesting.
Yeah, you can view each as a take on, you know, what makes humans human, or what makes things that are not human not human, and where the gray area is in between. And you can look at each of these through that lens, and each has a different answer, which is a lot of fun. But a lot of some of these are just pure, like you said, flights of fancy, and they're fun to experience like that.
So, you wanna do Twitter questions at this point?
Sure. I think we have all of one.
An entire one.
A fantastic one.
But it's a powerful. It's a powerful one.
It is.
From my dear boy, Mr. Grant the Thief, of the Blade Licking Thieves and the Super Senpai podcasts. Much love to you, Grant. He asks, which part of the anthology has grown on you the most over time? Ink, what do you think?
I had an entirely different answer before I watched Cloud. But it's going to be Cloud, because I really don't think I had the mental facilities to appreciate what it was doing when I watched it originally. And sitting there watching it now, like, I was waiting for myself to burst into tears, and I did not, because it's not really that hard-hitting a feature, but it's just very slow and contemplative and very beautifully presented, and it's something that you kind of have to wait for yourself to slow down through the initial turbulence of youth to appreciate. At 40 years old now, yeah, I totally get it. Or at least I think I totally get it.
I would have to say I would probably give exactly the same answer as you have for Cloud. In lieu of that, though, I am going to talk a little bit more about Starlight Angel, because, you know, when I saw this in the early 90s, the 80s were not that far away. And culturally, we were transitioning out of that into, you know, the era of grunge and the 90s, you know, my teenage years. You know, this was before that. I mean, like, this was a long time ago. You know, I just mentioned to Ink before the show that I took my littlest of sisters to a con, you know, just this past weekend. It was Hamacon up in Huntsville, Alabama. Big love to those folks. That was a great show. And she's 13 years old. Even she is older than I was when I saw Robot Carnival for the first time, because, you know, this was very early in my anime watching life. So as a not quite 40-year-old, but will be soon, Starlight Angel now has a very different effect on me. It's, you know, for one thing, I wasn't so much into the can't even talk today. Let me try that again.
I missed that category of
for one thing, as a younger viewer in my journey, I just wasn't as much into Bishojo stuff then as I appreciate it now. And so that's one thing that's kind of grown and changed with me. The other is the nostalgia with which I look back on that entire aesthetic. So, Kitazume, again, his visual stylings are like him and, you know, Mikimoto and Bubblegum Crisis, Riding Bean, Gunsmith Cats, freaking Kenichi Sonoda. Whew. I was about to be really upset with myself. When I'm thinking 80s and that aesthetic and that visual style, that's who I think of. I don't even think of Otomo, for crying out loud, which, you know, I don't think of Akira, which is what probably most people do. That's what I think of. So for me, that nostalgic sort of emotional, nostalgic, you know, reminiscence kind of ride that I went on when I watched that segment again, Starlight Angel again, was really unexpectedly affecting, like, to the point where now I just want to go watch a bunch of Elgin, like, now. You know, so thank you, Grant, for that Twitter question.
And I do want to say, like, we're just talking about nostalgia and looking back and growth of appreciation across the years. I don't think we've mentioned this directly, but this was released in 1987. So this is 30 plus years ago. And honestly, this is one of the best things about anthology films, is it showcases personal style as opposed to a series built on style. So say you love something like Space Dandy, where it's individual styles applied to a certain property, but then you strip any sort of coherence except theme, and then let the creators just be themselves visually, I guess script wise, give them total control and just let them submit an idea and run with it. And that's kind of the beauty of these kind of films, is you get so many perspectives and a differentiation of art styles that you will not get anywhere else, because everything else is adhering to one director and the culmination of several animation directors and episode directors, but they're all going towards a unified aesthetic. In these films, you get multiple aesthetics that bring you into a central theme, and I think that's very important.
Yeah, and the take on just that theme of robots. I almost kind of hope the conversation was just like, hey guys, we're going to do an anthology, check this out, here's your inspiration, robots, go.
It's very Cowboy Bebop, where, hey, we want a show with spaceships. Go.
Yeah, and you get this incredibly wide-ranging landscape of shows, or segments, I guess I should say, across the anthology. And it's just, golly, it holds up so well. Every one of these holds up so well. And, you know, again, for the kiddos in the audience, this is hand-drawn stuff, y'all. This is people with honest-to-God cells, painting cells, painting lots of cells to do an entire film, 90 minutes of 24 frames a second. That is crazy to think of the amount of painstaking detail that went into this thing, and just how well it holds up. I was not prepared for how well it held up, even on a DVD. Was not prepared.
Ditto. They put a lot of effort into making it, so you should put a lot of effort in seeking out a copy, which doesn't require a lot of effort, and watch it.
Yeah, Right Stuff, Discotech, wherever you want to get this thing.
It's under $20.
It's gonna be the best less than $20 you spend. Like, on anime, pretty much guaranteed. Really great. Ink, where can people find you on the interwebs?
On the interwebs, you can find me at animegamers.com. By the time this episode comes out, we will have already been reaching out to our consultants to start producing another 3-episode test column, because summer 2018 is upon us. And there are so many bad and good shows to watch. So, yeah, look forward to that. Also, listen to the Anagamers podcast proper. That's hosted by Evan Minto and David Australia. But also, you can find me on Fandom Post. I contribute to the column 10 Years Later, where we take a look back and see how things are holding up 10 years later. I think I've got a couple things coming up on Initial D, and a few other things. And go check out Taiku Podcast. I'm their official Bad Sports Anime correspondent, and oh my god, do we have so much to write about this season, or podcast about this season.
Yes, this will be, oh boy, I look forward to hearing that.
Badminton, volleyball, archery, come on, bring it.
Yeah. It will be ripe for the picking.
How about you, Jared? Where can we find you on the interwebs?
You can find me at on Twitter, at SaveVersusJared. Gonna tell you also, if you're interested in games that are mostly of the cardboard and pen and paper RPG variety, follow Electrum Edition. That is my blog for that kind of stuff. And we've got some more articles coming out on that fairly soon. I've actually taken some time this weekend and outlining kind of the new structure. Ink apparently wants to play some kind of Oktoberfest game he bought at an anime convention after he had too much booze. I might, if you guys are interested and you tweet me at Electrum Edition, if you want to see if I can get Ink to do that on camera.
Oh, dear God.
Maybe we can work that out. That's what you get. That's what you get for showing me. So, yeah, follow Electrum Edition for thoughts about games and more to come on that. And, yeah, that's it. That's it right now. Hopefully I'm going to get some 3-episode testing in if I can make it work with my crazy work schedule. But we'll see, hopefully.
So thank you for everybody for tuning in. Remember to leave us 5-star reviews and actual reviews where you tell us what you thought and what you'd like to hear, what you didn't like. And tune in next month. We'll have another something awesome for you ready. And until that time, enjoy both 2 podcasts, the Ergo Proxy episode and this one, as sort of a double flavor of the month.
Have a good one.
you're old Taku. She should know it should take some time. It's okay.
Yeah, case in point, we had to have her naps before we got on to talk about her animu.